Good afternoon. My name is John Alterman. I'm the director of the Middle East program here at CSIS, and it's my pleasure to welcome you for the launch of the paperback edition of Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War. The author, Anthony Shadid, is somebody who I think a lot of us have read for some time. He's the Middle East correspondent of The Washington Post. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting from Iraq. He previously worked as the Middle East correspondent of the AP in Cairo, was wounded in Ramallah, I remember that quite distinctly, and also worked as a diplomatic correspondent of the Boston Globe here in Washington. What you don't know from his bio, the fact that he's a Lebanese-American, he grew up in Oklahoma, speaks and reads Arabic, is Anthony and I met each other in Cairo about 15 years ago. I don't think either of us thought either of us would ever get a job doing this stuff. But Anthony had the sense that to be a reporter, which is what he wanted to do, it actually would make a difference if he spoke Arabic, and he didn't speak Arabic, and he learned Arabic, and I think his reporting is a consequence of the fact that he brings an American sensibility, a sense of personal connection to the region, an incredible humanity and humaneness to the topic, as well as his Arabic-speaking ability, and I think the reporting reflects it. I've read an awful lot of books in my day. I have read very few books that have impressed me as much as this book, because this is a book that you simply cannot read from any other author. There's nobody else who will go out and report this book. There's nobody else who will make you feel that connection with the characters. There's nobody else who's telling these stories besides Anthony. It is, quite simply, I think, not only the most impressive book that I've read on the Iraq War, but the most unique book. It's not on the spectrum. It doesn't have the overlap with the other books on Iraq. This is a book that really stands out because it talks about the people and the humanity of Iraq, and it traces them from the brutality of Saddam Hussein to the optimism of the liberation to the pessimism of the rising violence. Anthony is, I guess, running out to Beirut tomorrow. We were absolutely delighted to be able to grab him just before he left. He will talk to us about his book and about Iraq. And ladies and gentlemen, it is my real pleasure to introduce my friend Anthony Shadid.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be with you all tonight. I appreciate you coming after the work day to hear me talk about this. And I want to thank John for that. That was very, very kind. It was too kind. I mean that, what he said. And it's fun. I mean, I wish I could have got here a little bit earlier. I'm seeing all these old friends, which is the best part of this. And I made a point that I would mention my daughter in the audience too, Layla, who wanted that pointed out. So it's great to see everyone. You know, I have to say, I always feel a little awkward speaking because rather than writing, because I do one better than the other. And if anybody has trouble hearing, you know, if I speak too fast or if they can't hear me, I don't mind being interrupted at all. It's in fact, I'd prefer that. So, you know, I wanted to talk as much about Night Draws Near as about reporting and Iraq and try to tie it all together some way. And it always strikes me, I think, as you know, as someone who's been in the Middle East, you know, off and on since 1995, is how much reporting itself has changed and how much the job in some ways has changed. I remember when I went back to, when I was in Cairo in 1995, a colleague of mine who was leaving the region said, you know, you have to understand that the story is just dead here. It's not headed anywhere. And I wondered about that. That was only 10 years ago, amazingly. But since 2001, I basically just covered war. One story after the other having to do with war, be it Israel and Palestine, be it Iraq, and most recently the conflict in Lebanon this summer. And to be honest, I find it very difficult. I don't really understand what the term war correspondent means. I'm not really sure what foreign correspondent means either. But, I mean, I don't think war is all that meaningful to cover as an idea or as a concept. I think the adjectives become redundant, the ideas become redundant and repetitive, and you're left trying to make sense of something that I think is very, very difficult to make sense of. And what I've tried to do, and not always successfully, is to understand war as a backdrop to a more, I think, intimate drama in some way that plays itself out you know, to try to make the to try to understand the human stories, the human narrative. And I think we're dealing with a region that in a lot of ways has become dehumanized. I'm speaking about the Arab world. And, you know, amid that dehumanization, I think we have to ask ourselves as reporters and as journalists, how do we convey, how do we most powerfully convey the stories that we're writing about? And to me, that is understanding the human story, is being able to relate to the mother who sends her son off to fight, the father who loses a daughter or a son to a car bombing. And when they are in those terms, then I think it does bring a in some ways, it makes it more meaningful. And this is something that has happened in Iraq, I think, over the past few years of reporting. And I remember one story that's really stuck with me in doing this. It's a story I reported a couple of years ago. And I think all my time there in that country, in 1998 with the AP, 2002 with the Boston Globe, and then, of course, with the Washington Post since 2003, it's the story that lingers with me in a way. There's words that I heard in interviews there that I have trouble forgetting. And I want to maybe start with that and talk a little bit more about it. When we look at reporting in Iraq today, it's kind of breathtaking to realize what we used to be able to do back in 2003, in particular 2003, and to a lesser extent in 2004. You could basically do any story you wanted back then as long as you were dogged enough, determined enough, and had enough energy to go about it. And this was one of these stories that I was reporting during that time. I think it was May of 2003. And if we think back to that period, it was unclear that there was an insurgency underway. It was still very early. Saddam had only fallen weeks before. And there was an operation that was taking place in a town called Dhul-Ulayya. It's about 90 minutes north of Baghdad. It's actually a beautiful town, almost like an oasis on the banks of the Tigris. And I'd gone up there to try to cover the aftermath of a military operation. And again, because it was such an unsure time, it was so uncertain in so many ways, even the idea of an insurgency, this operation had taken on a little bit more meaning. It was relatively big. It was 4,000 U.S. troops. It was known as Operation Peninsula Strike. And I think in some ways this military operation that happened back in May of 2003 set the standard in some ways about how the military waged its counterinsurgency campaign. They went in pretty aggressively. Scores of people were arrested. And during those arrests, they relied on a young man to try to help them navigate the landscape, a young man named Sabah. Now, Sabah had volunteered his services to the American military. He was going to help them identify people that were, you know, suspected insurgents that were up to that type of work. And it was, of course, a dangerous job. The military had tried to disguise Sabah. They had put a burlap bag over his head. They dressed him in military camouflage, the same colors that the military was wearing. And they led them. They led him through the detainees who had been gathered there in the town square with handcuffed and sitting under the sun. Sabah pointed out several Americans. He did point out several suspected insurgents. He did his job. But his disguise didn't last all that long, and pretty soon the villagers realized what was going on. They noticed that his pinky above the middle joint was gone. He had lost it in a machine accident. They noticed that he was wearing yellow sandals. They even noticed his gait. And I think in villages like this, people are very aware of who's an outsider and who's not. And they realized that this was, in fact, Sabah. Three people had died during this military operation, including a 15-year-old boy whose body was found bloated on the banks of the Tigris a few days later. The villagers were upset, obviously, and the anger at Sabah's role in this campaign built over the days that followed and the weeks that followed. At one point, one of the relatives of one of the men who had been killed went to Sabah's father, and he basically delivered him an ultimatum. He said that Sabah's father had to kill his son, or that the villagers would kill Sabah's father and the rest of his family. Now, his father appealed. He said, "We don't know that it was, in fact, Sabah. Nobody saw his face." They rejected that. He said, "I have to talk to the Americans. I have to talk to the American military and get approval before I would do anything like this." And again, they rejected it. They made it very clear he had to kill his son or he and his family would die. And a few weeks passed, and Sabah's father and Sabah's brother arrived into his room. They led him out behind the house, behind an area with orchards of fig and almond trees, vineyards and groves of oranges and tangerines. And after a few minutes, Sabah's father raised his rifle at his son. He fired one shot, which struck Sabah, I believe, in the leg. The accounts that I heard after this differed. Some people said that the father collapsed at that point, and Sabah's brother then raised his rifle, an AK-47, and he fired three more times. One of those shots struck Sabah in the head, and a few moments later, Sabah, who was a tall, husky 28-year-old, died. I had gone to Thule in part to talk to his father, to find out what had happened and how it had happened and why it had happened. And we sat in his simple home of cement and cinder blocks. I remember he was nervously thumbing black prayer beads, and the fans overhead were churning air that felt oven-like. And each word of this conversation was labored. And silently, I had played it over in my head, the question I had to ask, which was, had he killed his son? And I already knew the answer, but I realized when the opportunity arrived, I couldn't ask him. Even as a journalist in a job that I think celebrates provocation sometimes and whose standards require confirmation, I couldn't muster the courage to broach the question. The moment felt, I think, in a lot of ways too tragic. It felt too wretched. And you had the sense that there still had to be decency. In a lot of ways, I don't think I wanted to hear him say yes. And I didn't want to humiliate him any further. And in the end, I didn't have to. His words were deepened by age and grief. I remember they were soft, almost a whisper. He was dragging on a cigarette, and his eyes at that point were shimmering. There was a faint trace of tears. And he said this to me, "I have the heart of a father, and he's my son." His eyes were cast to the ground. Even the prophet Abraham didn't have to kill his son. He stopped for a moment and he steadied his voice. There was no other choice. I've often talked about this story that I reported back in 2003, and I think the reaction sometimes has been that it illustrates a certain brutality that we see in Iraq today. A friend of mine pointed this out to me, and I shuddered at the thought, to be honest. Is that what it really showed? Or did it show something deeper, something less perceptible? I think Sabah's death to me was less a story of brutality and more a tale of the repercussions of a country turned upside down, a landscape that could give rise to such a crime. And I think in that reading, it becomes a metaphor in a way, a metaphor for the devastation of what I call unintended consequences. To me, probably the most powerful lesson of our experience in Iraq. I think in one narrative, the narrative you often hear here, is that the United States came as a liberator. I think almost immediately became an occupier. But most important, I think looking back over these years of reporting, it served as a catalyst for consequences that most of us, and include me and other journalists who were there, that most of us never foresaw. And whenever I come across this notion, this idea of unintended consequences, I think back to a man that I met long before today's chaos, before the invasion, before the occupation. It was back in 2002, and a colleague of mine had told me that there's one person I should speak to in trying to make sense of what was going on. And this person was Wamid Nathma. He became a dear friend of mine over the years. He's a burly academic. He's 62 years old. He had short-cropped gray hair and a cough from a lifelong cigarette habit. And then, and even now, I saw him most recently in October, I found him somebody that speaks with a certain clarity, that has a sense of both the country and the city around him. And to be honest, I found him always to be very remarkable. There's a reason he could be forthright back then, that he could speak with this candor. And he shared the story once with me as we sat in his house before the invasion, a few weeks before the invasion. Back in 1959, Wamid was still in the Ba'ath Party. He later left in the 1960s. He had gone to Cairo, Egypt, after being arrested and tortured, and he had promised that he would never be arrested or tortured again. And while he was in Cairo, he had received orders from the Ba'ath Party leadership to receive seven people who were headed his way. Now, these seven people had been involved in an assassination attempt on Iraq's leader at the time. The attempt had failed, and they made their way first to Damascus and then their way to Cairo. And, you know, Wamid, still being a cadre in the party, went to the airport to meet them. It turns out that one of these seven men was a young Saddam Hussein. And Wamid took the men. I think they spent a few nights at his apartment. And then they went different ways, and he never really stayed in touch with him. They were acquaintances, but little more. Until a year later, Wamid had heard that Saddam was getting his tonsils taken out. And Wamid thought, well, being a fellow Iraqi, I should go visit him. I should see how he's doing. And so he showed up at the hospital, at Asad al-Aini Hospital in Cairo. And it turned out he was the only visitor. No one else had decided it was worth seeing how Saddam was doing. And in the days before before the U.S. invasion, Wamid recounted the story and what it may have meant to his later years in Baghdad. Here are his words. "I usually don't like waking up early in the morning, but I thought, you know, he's by himself, so I went to the hospital. Perhaps this is one of the reasons why Saddam did not cut off my head. I think somehow he had good memories of me." With me, then, I was sitting at his his house in Adamiyah. And like a lot of other people in Baghdad, I think he was trying to make sense of the cacophony that was going on around him. It was an unsettled time. It was uncertain. And like I said, we were basically waiting for the invasion to begin. And here are his words again. "I won't hide my feelings. The American invasion has nothing to do with democracy and human rights. It's basically an angry response to the events of September 11th, an angry response to the survival of Saddam Hussein. And it has something to do with oil interests in the area. I remember he talked about the 1990 invasion of Kuwait and suggested, I thought unusually, that the U.S.-led attack in that instance might have been justified. But what about more than a decade of sanctions and now another war? It will bring more destruction, more civil war, and a nationalist war against American intervention in the internal affairs of Iraqis. Even if the Americans are capable of overthrowing the regime," he said, "they will face more and more resistance from factions and groups who are not necessarily pro-regime or armed by the regime. This is not politics," he said. He paused for a moment. "This is a circus." My conversations, and I think especially that one back in 2002, always struck me. I think in a way there was a hint there of what was ahead. It was a voice that even back in those days splashed color across a landscape that was often monochromatic. It signaled the complexity of what I and I think a lot of other journalists who were working there would soon encounter. You know, looking back on those years, I think there's no question that repression determined much of what happened in Iraq before the U.S. invasion. It was overwhelming, and it was suffocating. I don't think there's any question that it was one of the century's worst dictatorships. But looking back, I think our nearly absolute emphasis on that all-encompassing tyranny blinded us in a lot of ways to everything else that was there. Time and again, we envisioned the simple two-dimensional portrait of a country. Iraqis, we were told, were trapped in this relation of submission and victimization, its people voiceless. Once the dictator was removed by force if need be, Iraq would be a blank slate, a tabula rasa in a sense, on which the United States could build a new and different state. And I do think I spent my entire time after that conversation in 2002, realizing, in a slow process of realizing, of understanding how wrong that was. When I look back on my years as a reporter, I realize I essentially covered the unintended consequences of the invasion. It was the gray that Wamith pointed out in that conversation so long ago, his prediction in the grimmest terms of a circus. It was the tumult, I think, that emerged so quickly, the kind of chaos that led in part to Sabah's death at the hands of his father in Dhul-Ayya back in 2003. I got back from Iraq a couple of weeks ago now, probably 3 weeks ago, and on one of those days of reporting in Baghdad, I found myself back in Ferdows Square, and I think some people may remember the name and the symbolism of it. I was there in April 9th of 2003, and I remember the scene pretty well. It was, you know, the circle in some ways was oddly picturesque. There was a circle of columns around a statue of Saddam. On each column was written S and H at the top of it. On the stone perch was Saddam's statue in a coat and tie, his hand stretching down Saadun Street in kind of a socialist realist fashion. And over that afternoon, as the hours passed, dozens and then scores of people gathered, and they had one idea, which was to bring the statue down. They tried, and they didn't succeed until they were assisted by a Marine recovery vehicle, but it did suggest a certain symbolism. And I think on that day, in some ways very vivid, it marked the fall of the dictatorship. And I remember the day well. There were a lot of conflicting emotions about it. You know, as a journalist, you felt that the war was over in some ways, wrongly, of course, but and that you were going to be okay. And I remember also feeling a certain way as an American. I remember feeling a certain awe of the power of the United States. I remember thinking, what other nation, driven by ideology, its existence basically not threatened, could conquer another country in a matter of weeks? I remember thinking that the United States had inherited another country, and I was watching it happen. The United States now controlled Iraq's destiny. In a lot of ways, it was going to decide its fate. And to a remarkable degree, I think even back then, we realized how little we understood about it. Deep down, I worried that we wouldn't try to know it either. At best, we would try to force it into our construct and preconception of what a country should be. And at worst, we wouldn't care, giving into overly emotional impressions that were distorted by differences in language and tradition and cultures, and all too often by conceit and I think a certain arrogance. I went back to Fedotov Square a year later. This was April 2004, and again, I think people may remember what was going on back then. It was a very unsettled time. Baghdad was in some ways shaking. There was the fight between insurgents and the U.S. Marines in Fallujah, a battle that ended inconclusively. There was another fight going on in Baghdad and parts of southern Iraq between militiamen loyal to Muqtada Sadr and, again, the U.S. military, and another fight that ended inconclusively. I've always thought that, you know, as I stood in that square back in April 2004, it struck me that that I was watching another notion unfold, maybe another symbol in some ways. The square was deserted. It was guarded by U.S. tanks whose barrels read Beastly Boy and Bloodlust. Soldiers, edgy, had orders to shoot anyone with a weapon. And I remember at time music blared over speakers that had been set up on a Humvee there. One song was Ring of Fire by Johnny Cash. And on that day, I thought if the square maybe a year earlier had symbolized the fall, that was its symbolism. Today, it spoke, I think, in very visceral terms on that day to a certain notion of occupation. I ended up going to Fedotov Square last week, and part of it was in hopes of writing a story about what word or what phrase or what symbol might describe Baghdad today. And I've always thought that the longer I spent in Iraq, and I, this sounds kind of flip, but I actually mean it sincerely, that the longer I spent there, the less I understood it. I think that each month passed, it became more complicated, in some ways less easy to understand. And that felt really powerful to me when I was there in October. A few days earlier, I'd talked to a psychiatrist, asking him of what word or what phrase would describe Baghdad today. And I remember his words. "This is a civil war now," he told me. "And you see hundreds of people killed every day, corpses of people tortured in the streets every day. What else does it mean? Call it what you will, but it is a civil war." And I thought maybe, after I heard him speak, that might be the case. But I also thought that I was maybe witnessing something more, witnessing something a little more difficult to understand. And in some ways, it seemed like what was going on around me, what was going on in Baghdad and other parts of the country on that day was the final frenzied maturity of these once inchoate forces that were unleashed more than 3 years ago by that invasion. In a lot of ways, it was the visceral realization of these unintended consequences that would me that suggested back in 2002. I think on the one hand, there is a civil war style, sectarian killing going on, echoes of what we saw in Lebanon a generation ago back in the 70s and 80s. Alongside it, there are other things. There's a gangland style turf battle over money and power and survival, a raft of political parties, each with their own militia, and militia often being kind of a polite way to describe men with guns. There's a raging insurgency, collapse of authority, social services that remarkably 3 years later still don't really exist. And I think very importantly, no way forward for an Iraqi government that's ordered to act a certain way by Americans who themselves are still seen, and I stress seen, they're still perceived as the final arbiter, and as a result still deprive that government of its own legitimacy. As I stood in that square, I remember thinking that the Civil War was in a lot of ways too easy a term, almost too tidy a way to describe what Baghdad and much of Iraq has become today. I remember looking out at the square on one side of the square were rows of concrete barricades and barbed wire, themselves having faded almost organically into the landscape around them. In another direction, there was a billboard that read, "Terrorism has no religion." Across the street, there was a poster portraying Iraqi police, and they were pleading almost desperately, we are heroes fighting for the sake of Baghdad." And then in the middle of the square on that same stone perch where Saddam's statue once stood, there were scraps of posters, most of them having been torn down by this point. Words and phrases, "Your voice, the nation, patriotism, dialogue, building the future." And I remember the words were isolated, without context, almost like pieces of a puzzle. It's remarkable to think that we've been in Iraq almost as long as we fought World War II after Pearl Harbor. And I think those consequences are still playing themselves out before us. I have to say that I'm pessimistic about the future. I'm based in Beirut now, and I look out at a region, not only Iraq, but the rest of the Arab world, and I see a place that's riven by these same sectarian forces that are at play in Iraq right now. I think ideology has in many ways died in the Middle East, be it Arab nationalism, various leftist ideologies, and so on. And whatever the successes or failures of those ideologies, there was a universality that in some ways transcended the parochial identities of the past. And I don't think that's the case any longer. In its place is a more primordial notion of self, as Sunni Muslims, as Shiite Muslims, as Kurds, as Christians, and so on. Identity has become first and foremost the axis around which politics are organized today. And I think in the end you're left with tribes that are bereft of citizenship. Each tribe comes away with its own existential sense of itself, its very survival threatened by its own uniqueness. You know, from that same perch, I think from Beirut, I see the impact of the war on American standing today. Without question, I think it's lowest point in recent memory. To be honest, there's an anger out there that's deep and it's visceral and it's withering. And I wonder about its implications. I think a lot of people here are probably better equipped to answer that question than I am. But I do think back to similar moments in the Middle East and the repercussions of those conflicts, the way the 1967 Arab-Israeli War spoke to the ascent of political Islam in some ways, how the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon served as the genesis of Hezbollah. I think back to the 1991 Gulf War and the way that charted the direction for Osama bin Laden in some ways. And I do wonder what this war's legacy is going to be for the region. I think we're already starting to see signs of it in places like Jordan and northern Lebanon. But I don't think we're going to see the full brunt of it for years. And I do worry about that. And finally, I think there are the consequences for Iraq itself. I think back to three people I met as a way of speaking to those repercussions in a way. I think they're the voices that are often lost amid the chaos and the anarchy and to be blunt, the carnage that visits Baghdad and what amounts to killing fields. I think it's the debris that are left in the wake of these same unintended consequences that I've mentioned before. One of these people was a woman named Karima Salman. I met Karima back in 2003 during the invasion, and I'd gone to see her because I wanted to do a story about an Iraqi mother who was going to send her son off to fight. I was struck by her. She was poor. She was selling chewing gum on the sidewalk at that point to support eight people, five of them daughters. She was scared. And I kept in touch with them after the invasion as the months passed. I think it's rare for a male reporter, for a man in the Middle East, to have access to women's voices. And that was important to me to try to get that perspective. In a time, I became friends with them. When I went and saw them last year, it was actually a little bit after June 23rd, 2005, and three car bombs had just gone off outside their home. It had wrecked the mosque across the street, and it had thrown shrapnel and debris and glass through her window, cutting the forearm of one of her daughters, Hiba. She had nerve damage. Kids at the school nicknamed her Shrapnel Hiba after that. 2 months ago, another car bomb went off pretty much in the same place, and it hurled the same things through her window, and this time it cut the head of Hiba's twin sister, Doa. She had four stitches to seal that wound. In the 11 months between when I had seen Karima and her family and when I saw them in October, she had lost her job as a maid at the Palm Hotel. She was making about $30 a month, but simply put, there were no one was coming to the hotel anymore. I saw her son, Ali, who, when I'd met him during the invasion, was to be honest, he was kind of a ne'er-do-well. And he belonged to Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party militia at the time. When I saw him in October, he had joined the Mahdi Army, the same militia that's loyal to Sadr and who's blamed for a lot of the sectarian killings going on today. Her son-in-law, who's also named Ali, had been a police officer in the U.S.-trained and equipped police force. He had received death threats, left that job, and then when I saw him, like I said, in October, he too had joined the Mahdi Army, that same militia. And I remember it's kind of an odd moment, but I remember when I was sitting with her family, I was staring at her grandson. He was a 2-month-old boy. And when you drive through Baghdad today, when you talk to people, it is kind of remarkable that there's one emotion, there's one sentiment that is so overpowering and that you come across time and again. That's fear. Fear is everywhere there right now. And I remember staring at this little boy, and I was trying to figure out what was so different about him, and I realized that it was the first time in a couple of weeks that I'd seen eyes that weren't fearful. And Karima noticed this, and she saw me staring at her grandson, and she eventually turned to me during the conversation and said, "Is it not a pity to bring a baby into a world like this? It's a shame." I went to try to find another friend of mine, a guy named Farouk Sa'adeddin. Last time I'd seen Farouk, he was in the neighborhood of Jihad, which is in some ways too dangerous, I think, at this point to enter. When I saw him, he was upset. His oldest son, Omar, had just left the country. He had gone to London. And Farouk was worried about what this meant for the future of Iraq. What did it mean when it's best and brightest, when it's most capable, we're going to leave? Here were his words back then. You can't just cut out and run away. This is our country, and sooner or later our children will come back. The resilience of the people, that's what 11,000 years of history means. Someone who has 11,000 years, 100 years to lose here or there, isn't that much. On April 17th of this year, Farouk and Mona, his wife, both left the country. They went to Jordan, where their son had rented an apartment for them, paid a year's rent in Amman. A month after they left, a car bomb went off outside their home, in their Baghdad home in Jihad. It shattered that window next to the room where we had sat and drank coffee and talked about Omar leaving. And when I tracked him down in Amman, he was still kind of stunned, I think, about the arbitrariness of fate, how he'd escaped certain death. And I remember his words well, also. We're all stranded, here and there, Iraqis. And finally, there was this friend of mine that I'd met back in 2002, Wamid Nathma, who I'd stayed in touch with over the years and who I went to visit when I was there in October. And when I saw him, he explained to me how he'd basically settled into what he called withdrawal. He still went to the university once a week, but Baghdad had become too dangerous to venture outside. I remember leaving his house at 7 o'clock, an hour after dusk, and I was struck about how the streets looked. They looked like they might look a couple of hours before dawn. There wasn't any traffic. They were dark. And in a lot of ways, they were very menacing. And as we sat and talked in his house, gunfire burst almost continuously, and helicopters rumbled overhead. I remember at one point, I think he realized the ruckus that was going outside, and he turned to me and said, "You feel like the country's exploding." We talked for a little while, and at one point in the conversation, I asked him, would it become worse if the Americans withdrew? And I remember his response. He looked at me for a moment. He seemed kind of confused, and then he finally said, "What could be worse?" I went and saw him again a week later. I was having dinner with him and his family. And this question that I'd asked him that on that previous visit had lingered with him a little bit. Here were his words. I sometimes wonder what I would do if I were the Americans. His answer, what I thought in itself was a lesson, seemed to hurt him. I have no idea, really. It's like a volcano that has erupted. How do you stop that? And I thought it was a fitting question to ask. Thank you.
We have a little bit of time for questions and discussion. We also have some roving microphones, so everybody will be able to hear. If you would raise your hand, the three rules I like to have is, first, if you would identify yourself. Second, only ask one question, so if we have a lot of questions, everybody can get a chance. And third, if you could ask your question in the form of a question, which is not to say a statement, and then what do you think about that? So right over there in the back. Two microphones.
My name is David Hoffman, and I write for Sojourners magazine that Jim Wallace edits, but I also am working now with the transition team of Virginia's new senator-elect, Jim Webb. My question, and it is in the form of a question, you're a journalist, of course, and therefore you cannot advise the United States Senate, which gathers this week in the lame duck. Some would call it the dead duck session. But anyway, you can't advise senators beginning in January also what they're going to do about this catastrophe, if that's what it is. But here's the question, since you can't advise. Do you think, this is asking you more as a journalist to be a prophet, do you think that in the next 6 months, based on all your experience as a journalist and an observer of the human race and its political leadership in this country, do you think that in the next 6 months or year that the political class in America, the power elite in the Senate, can they muster the will to stop? The first rule of being in a hole is to stop digging. Can they stop digging and find a way out?
No, to be honest, when Meath said this to me, when we were having that conversation in October, he said, "I have no idea what I would do." I felt very sympathetic because I don't either. And I always feel bad when I kind of do these talks about Iraq because I am bleak about what's ahead. I really am. I think it's – when I went back in October, I didn't expect it to be as bad as it was. And to be honest about that, it was as I keep using these words, grim and bleak, and I guess I'll just keep using them over and over. I don't know the answer. I don't know if there is an answer. I don't think there is an American answer to this at this point. I mean, if there ever was one. You know, I think there's a lot of talk about these things that are thrown out, partition, you know, gradual withdrawal and these types of things. I don't see where they're going. Partition's a whole different story. But, you know, the only thing that gives me a little bit of hope, and I'll say this, and I usually get these things wrong. When I make predictions, they're usually wrong, so I should preface every comment after that with this. But, you know, the only thing that gave me a little bit, like just a flicker of hope, when I was having a conversation with a few, to generalize, a few Sunni politicians, and they made this point that they were still trying to figure out how they were going to restore the alliance with Sadr. And I thought that was remarkable. I mean, we're talking about there's been so much bloodletting over the past, especially since Samarra this spring, and that they were still talking about trying to restore an alliance that, you know, probably hasn't been there, if it was there, since the spring of 2004. I thought it was remarkable. And I think it speaks, and I may be being a little naive here, but I think it speaks at a certain level to a lingering capacity for compromise among Iraqi leaders. Now, I think, what's the word I want to use here? I don't think the American presence there helps that capacity, and I don't think it helps that process. And I wonder if that some kind of compromise could take place in the shadow of what you still have this lingering question of legitimacy as long as the Americans are there. I don't know. I don't see it happening as long as there is a U.S. presence, because I think it does change the dynamic pretty fundamentally in the country. Now, could it happen after the Americans leave? Maybe, but it does feel like, you know, these forces we've talked about, these unintended consequences that have gone on. I wonder how they're going to be dented at this point. But that is a little bit of hope I have, that I think there is still a capacity for compromise down the road.
Question there, Chris?
I'm just wondering across the board the sense.
Sorry, can you identify yourself if you would?
Yeah, Nahida Zaid with Al Jazeera International. Across the board, the feeling of Iraqis toward the Americans. I mean, you've talked to this, you know, variety of groups. What's your sense?
You know, this is, it's also very anecdotal, obviously. And I was in Baghdad and Basra, and then a little bit in the countryside just for a couple of days. And I guess what I was struck more than Baghdad, you know, I've always felt Baghdad to be, you know, let me say two things. You know, the anger and resentment that you used to hear often pronounced back in 2004, I didn't feel it as sharp this time. And I think it was mainly because there was a lot of despair at this point. You know, I think people like Wamid have the city itself has become atomized in a way. And I think people have kind of withdrawn indoors, trying to wait it out. And it struck me how often I would ask people, did you ever expect it to reach this point? And how many times people would say, no, never. I didn't hear that, you know, a year or two ago. So I think the sense of, like, toward the Americans has changed in some ways. There is still a constituency in the country, no question, that thinks if the Americans left, it would be an utter bloodbath. So you still hear that as well. What struck me in Basra was Basra, you know, I got into Basra thinking it was going to be a little bit better, and it is a little bit better. There's no question about it. People are actually out in the streets at night. And you know what he said to people? It was often really, I don't know, people always seem to try to be kind of careful about their comments about the British and what the British presence amounted to. And it did strike me how decisively that had shifted when I was there. How, you know, people just kind of given up at this point. Just they've had enough of it. And I didn't really expect to hear that. And, you know, in some ways I have to say, as much, I went down there thinking Basra was going to be, it was better. And it was better, but in some ways it's also kind of Baghdad light. I mean, there's quite a bit of killing going there as well. So I guess just to try to summarize, and I'm not giving you a real clear answer on this, but I think it is, you know, I think there's such a question of survival at this point. There's so much despair and so much pessimism that in some ways the Americans aren't the focus the way they might once were.
Right there.
I'm Sally Guerin, and I don't know if your wife would be interested in answering this question.
It's my mother, actually.
Your mother.
But you get points for that.
That's right. Use me the best friend.
I'll address it to your mother. Do you have a philosophy that you feel is important to you as you watch him fly off?
You're putting us.
I'm so proud of the job he's doing. It's not calming, but I'm with him totally.
I had when I was in southern Lebanon, I tried to go to this place called Sarifa, and there was a report that I think 60, 70 people had been killed. And I had my driver there was a communist dentist, a very funny guy. He didn't have any patients during the war, so he would drive me around. And, you know, we drove and drove. It was about 10 miles away, and we finally got close to it, and we couldn't get into the village itself. And we thought about walking, and then we said we couldn't walk, so we went back to Tyre. And he didn't say a word to me the whole way back, and then we pulled into near the hotel, and he said, "Anthony, I want you to give me the telephone number for your father." And he goes, "I'm going to call him and tell him what you're doing." I was, "Please don't call my father."
Hi, Hanan al-Badri, Rosa Youssef. I just wonder, how can you describe the insurgent group in Iraq? Are they a resistant group, Mukawama, or are they terror, as many people like to call them here in Washington?
You know, I have such a less of sense of the insurgency, to be honest, than I did back in 2004. I mean, there was still, I think even in 2004, there was still some access you could have to what was going on. At this point, you know, other than through embeds, you really just can't get into the region where it's strongest. And I feel very unsure about what the shape of it and the direction it's headed. I mean, I think, you know, these terms we use, you know, resistance, terrorist, all this kind of stuff, it's a lot of different things. I think there's a lot of different currents out there. And I'm struck as we look ahead over the next year or two, I think in some ways the intrasectarian things may be more pronounced than intersectarian. I mean, I think that's something that, and I think there are fissures and conflicts going on out west that haven't been resolved or settled. But I do think these, like, you know, for instance, in Basra and Nasiriyah and Amara, you know, the contest between Shiite militias, how, you know, who wins out in the West, and these, when it's clear there are disagreements out in the West between Sunni insurgent groups, you know, I think these are in some ways are going to create a dynamic that determines the future of the country more than perhaps the sectarian bloodletting that we're seeing going on between Sunnis and Shiites. But the exact nature of those conflicts, especially at West, I don't know at this point. But it is a diverse group, there's no question.
Could you discuss or describe the sort of rise of sectarian identities? I mean, you talked about how now it's going to the rest of the Middle East, and the primordial identifications are becoming so vital. Nobody was really talking about this in 2002, 2003. I have a friend who worked for the CPA who said that the CPA didn't sow the seeds of sectarian discord in Iraq, but in many cases it watered them very carefully. As somebody who spent the time in which this developed in country, could you talk a little bit about that process of deepening sectarian division identification?
Yeah, I think the way he put it is actually very interesting, because, I mean, there was this notion, I think, going into Iraq back in 2003, there was this kind of superficial understanding of the country as a country of Sunnis, Shiites, and Kurds. It was that in some levels, but it would be the same way as, like, you know, defining America solely in terms of race relations. I mean, it wasn't the only act, again, I use this phrase, axis around which politics revolved. I think policies that were set up by the CPA after that definitely did sharpen that identity. I think from the GC on, you know, this idea of quotas, this idea of explicit sectarian identification to politicians and political figures, I think it went a long way in kind of reshaping this notion of identity in the country. And then I think there was a very intense intersection between the CPA policies and the agendas of the exile parties that obviously stood to gain pretty markedly from what from that process. And I think those two forces intersect in really destructive ways. When you look at Baghdad, and again, this is very anecdotal, and I'm saying this as a reporter, not as an academic. I mean, you know, I wouldn't argue that it wasn't there. Of course, it was there, and it colored so much about Iraq in so many ways. But, you know, just in a kind of a daily life, I mean, the idea of asking someone whether they're Sunni or Shiite, I mean, you wouldn't ask that. I mean, the idea of neighborhoods being explicitly Sunni or Shiite, it was sometimes, but not all that often. Intermarriage was very common. And I think it's interesting when you go to Amman today how little sectarian differences are pronounced. I mean, obviously, it's a different kind. It's more educated and better off communities in both Amman and Damascus. But it's striking how different the sectarian kind of landscape is there and compared to Iraq these days. You know, now it's hard to overstate how sharp it's become. I mean, even an insider office of the Washington Post, a bureau that's worked together for 3 years, since 2003, we've been through a lot together. It's basically broken into Sunni and Shiite cliques at this point. I mean, and it's all this distrust, you know, mistrust and suspicion and very pronounced. And I think that's in some ways just like a, you know, microcosm of what you're seeing going on elsewhere. I mean, the very geography of Baghdad is shifting, where there are, you know, there's going to eventually be a Sunni and a Shiite half on each bank of the Tigris. And I think people have been there over time. It's just, it's breathtaking to see that, you know, that process unfold. I think it is the legacy, the single most important legacy of this conflict for the country itself.
Thank you. John Donnelly from the Boston Globe. Anthony, can you describe just your tactics
now in reporting in Iraq and how you do it, and what you see as for other journalists there or journalists going in, sort of effective ways of trying to cover it.
Yeah, I still think there's more work being done in Baghdad than people maybe realize here. I mean, people are still getting out, and there are certain neighborhoods you can still go to. I mean, there's a lot of neighborhoods that are off limits at this point, and you know, some people are being killed. I mean, there are. You know, if you go into a neighborhood as a stranger, odds are you will be killed at this point. I mean, just because of the, you know, everyone's afraid that it's a car bomb or it's something like that. But there are still, you know, Kadhimiya, Sadr City a little bit, not really. Karada, I mean, there are neighborhoods that you can go in and stay, not for very long, probably 30 or 45 minutes. So there's work that is still done, and it can be done. And I think this notion that journalists aren't getting out at all is probably a little bit overstated because, you know, especially people that I haven't been there. Like I said, it was 11 months between October and when I'd been there last, and, you know, a lot of people are still doing that and trying to get out at least every day. It's incredibly different. And I think, you know, what I found just when I was there in October was you almost had to rely on stuff you've reported previously. In other words, you have to rely on those contacts going back to the – I mean, I basically went back to everybody I had met or written about for the book. When I went down to Basra, I was with a friend that had a good sense of it. And when I was in Basra, I didn't talk to any of the political parties just for fear that they're tied to the militias and that would get you in trouble, especially because I think I stayed down there 4 or 5 days. So the people I interviewed in Basra itself were all very – not apolitical necessarily, but just people who wouldn't be in touch with armed elements. And then when I went to the countryside, it was going to a village where I had worked during the election. And so I knew the guy, and it was a kind of a tribal sheikh, and he could – offer, I hate to say it, but we could offer protection, basically. So that's how I was trying to do it. And, you know, I think if you do that, there's still a lot you can do in that way. But trying to, like, you know, what I found frustrating, even when I was back there last year, was trying to break new ground in some ways I found very difficult. You know, I think there are ways to do it. I think it just takes time and patience. But you know, building new contacts, you know, finding new ways to tell the story. I was really, and part of that's part of the reason I hadn't gone back in so long, because I did find that so frustrating.
Ali, and then over here.
Ali Ahmed from the Gulf Institute. My question is, following the media, especially the Washington Post and major U.S. media, I noticed that they have somewhat ignored or overlooked the U.S. allies' role in fueling terrorism in Iraq and violence. So why is that? Why the U.S. government chose to ignore it, and the U.S. media seems also to have ignored the, you know, the thousands of Saudis going to Iraq and Jordanian help to the insurgency and the Saudi and the Qatari and everybody else. And the U.S. allies mainly.
Yeah.
Just they focus on Iran and Syria, by ignoring U.S. allies, which maybe have contributed the majority of the suicide bombers and the car bombs and so on.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I'm going to be really honest with you. I think that it's a question of access at one. I mean, how do you get information on this kind of stuff? And often it's going to come from U.S. intelligence. And I'll be really blunt about it. You know, I carry a certain skepticism when I hear what U.S. intelligence is reporting inside Iraq. And I think, you know, maybe that's too strong. I shouldn't probably say that, but I do, and I think some of it often is, you know, politically oriented. And you just have to be careful about how much you invest in it. So then it becomes the question: then how do you get access in other directions? And I think that's part of the reason we're not probably reporting it as aggressively or as forthrightly as we can. I mean, you look down in Basra, for instance, and you see the situation with Iranian intelligence, and it's breathtaking. I mean, you know, when you look at the Iranian profile today compared to 3 years ago, and how maybe it relative to what U.S. standing is in the region, it's, I guess, if you're an Iranian official, it's pretty impressive at this point. I mean, and I think especially in southern Iraq, we have, let's say, 18, 19 political parties in Basra, and I think probably each one of them is receiving Iranian funding to one degree or another. Even Sadr, actually, which is, you know, it was odd if you think about his kind of, you know, Iraqi nationalist, Arab nationalist, anti-Iranian type of kind of rhetoric. You know, my sense in southern Iraq, though, is it's different. That I can't speak to the Saudis or the Syrians or what's going on, especially out west. But what I did see in southern Iraq was that in some ways the Iranians are being restrained. I think, one, you have competing agendas within Iranian intelligence about how they're going to play on the landscape in southern Iraq. But I think they're also being restrained because they realize that, you know, if they're going to play cards down the road, they've lost their cards somewhat in Lebanon. So they do want to preserve this card if there's trouble between the United States and Iran. And I do feel it's kind of restrained down there. Not completely, by any means, and I think the British blame them for a lot of the insurgent attacks on British forces there, but it could be a lot worse. But there is no question that they have it I think they have it sewed up down there. I mean, really, it's pretty remarkable how the amount of influence they are playing at this point.
This gentleman here. And you, and then
Bob Shatter, American Foreign Policy Council. When security is so degraded in a place, one of the things I become kind of focused on is for whom and for what will people fight, die, and kill?
Mm.
And you get some sense, well, the Kurds will fight for Kurdistan, and there's divisions within the Kurds, and there's people will clearly fight for Sadr, and you don't get much of a sense of what the Sunnis are. Is it a tribal? I mean, the notion that they're fighting and dying for Saddam Hussein seems overtaken by events, I guess.
Yeah.
So what are the things for which the Sunnis and the non-Sadr Shia are fighting for and dying and killing for?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because I think that goes exactly. I mean, you know, again, I hesitate to speak too explicitly, but I think this notion of what you're fighting for, I think it ties into this question of legitimacy and what is recognized as something worth dying for and worth fighting for. And I think this is something that's been, it's a question that's been unanswered, and it's still unanswered at this point. You look at like these two guys that I mentioned that have been either in the Ba'ath Party militia or in the U.S. trained police force and now are part of the Mehdi army, and you listen to them talk, and it was remarkable to me. As I was sitting talking to Ali, he was like, we're defending Iraq. We're the only ones defending Iraq at this point. We're fighting the Americans. We're fighting what he would call the Wahhabis, you know, the idea of like Sunni extremists or whatever. But this real sense of like, you know, we're defending the country. His sister, of course, was yelling at him. I mean, it was a chaotic conversation. But it is that, I mean, this is, and I'll go to the Sunni thing after this, but there is this notion, I think, you know, the sectarian killings that, and I'll be blunt about this, the sectarian killings that are being committed by the Mehdi army or things, you know, there's a question of how much control Sadr is exerting over the militia at this point. But these killings are not unpopular among a certain constituency. A Shia constituency in Baghdad. I think there's a sense that the Shia were incredibly restrained for 2 years. They'd had enough, and now they're going to defend the community, and that's how the Mehdi army is being perceived, as defending the community. And so these killings are not necessarily unpopular. I think it speaks a lot to the present day in Iraq that you would have that sentiment, but it is often very powerfully expressed. And that's why Sadr, I mean, you know, when I met Sadr right after the invasion, you know, people were talking about how he was playing video games before the invasion, and now he's the kingmaker in the country. And it's in part this idea of defending the community, you know, playing a very sophisticated game of street politics. You know, when it comes to the insurgency, and I think this is the question, you know, that my colleague was asking here, I don't think there's been a political program that's been elaborated by the insurgency, at least that I'm not aware of. And there may have been, and there may be in some talks that are ongoing. But I've always been struck that when you look at the insurgency, how it is such a short term that they're fighting the Americans. And now, I think it's less when you get the Al-Qaeda types and this idea of fomenting sectarian strife and conflict like that. But the kind of more traditional mainstream insurgency, there is that. I don't get a real sense of looking ahead, that it is fighting the Americans. There's a foreign presence on Iraqi land. And that's basically the raison d'etre at this point. And that has served as a relatively good rallying cry, and it does keep the ranks together as much as it can if you keep that common enemy in place. But next year or two, of course, they're going to have to elaborate something more, probably more in depth, and it hasn't come out at this point.
Okay, we have time for a couple more questions, one there and then one there, and then we'll close. Sir.
Robert Werner. I'm with an international consulting firm called Managing Uncertainty, which I think describes the state of play in Iraq.
You might end up with a contract. I don't know if that's first prize or last prize.
It's been reported in the last 24 hours that General Casey has made another statement to the effect that he thinks in 18 months that the Iraqi forces will be ready to take over. Putting aside the very strong views on both the Democratic Party, Democratic leadership, and the Republican leadership in the White House, what do you personally think would happen if the United States government were to inform Iraq they would take that 18-month timeline and say, that's it, we're going to be out of there here in 18 months no matter what happens? What do you personally think would happen?
Personally, I think I probably shouldn't be saying this as a journalist. I think it would be the same as if they withdrew tomorrow. I just don't see what 18 months of a gradual withdrawal, of trying to set up some kind of political process that's going to be sustainable. I don't see it. I think everyone's going to be jockeying for that date of when they withdraw. And I think it's going to be bloody, and I think it's going to be very turbulent. But I think it's going to happen if they withdrew tomorrow, and it's going to happen if they withdrew in 18 months. I just, you know, we're not, you know, my sense is not that we're building towards something. It's rather that we're witnessing a certain entropy. And, you know, I don't know what the presence does to arrest that. I don't think it does. I don't, you know, but that is very much my opinion, and it may be wrong. And I remember sitting around with colleagues the last night in Baghdad, and they were like, they were shouting me down. So that was like ridiculous, and I hit it wrong. So it's not – people definitely disagree who are covering the story there. But I just – I don't even see how they're keeping a lid really on the violence at this point.
Last question right there.
So Hassan, and I'm representing myself here. The way you were describing Iraq and Baghdad sounds very much like Beirut during the Lebanese Civil War. Do you think it's going to be like the Lebanese War, where it lasted for 17 years and people pretty much killed each other based on the sect? And you probably know this, where when Beirut was pretty much divided into two sections, when you were describing Baghdad, like the eastern section was, I'm guessing, the Shiite section, and the western one was the Sunni one. That's pretty much reminiscent of Beirut. Is this where you see the war in Iraq going, at least sectarian violence? Is this where you see it going?
You know, it doesn't, boy, I hate to be so bleak. I mean, it just, yeah, you know, I never, Lebanon, I didn't live in Lebanon during the Civil War, and I didn't cover it either. So these are more kind of just my understanding of it and talking to people and their sense of it. And, you know, it reminds me more of Lebanon, I think, as the years pass. It never, used to not at all. Mainly just this, the pronounced notion of identity at this point, which is it's, I can't overstate how marked it has become. You know, the killing is still organized. As much as we see these tolls, these fantastic tolls, it is still organized at some degree. The victims aren't necessarily organized, but the people carrying out the killings, there's still a certain organization that keeps that killing going on. It's not neighbor on neighbor. It's not random in that sense. I don't, you know, these forces that we're seeing carry Iraq toward, you know, the sectarian bloodletting and toward this, you know, the effect of partition in some ways, I don't see what dents at this point. And so I do worry about where it's headed. It's hard for me to say, you know, how long it would go or what would happen. And I do have a little bit of optimism way down the road. But I think we're in for a really rough, very tough period.
Does that pass for an optimistic close? I'll give you an optimistic close. Copies of Anthony's book are available for sale outside. I will tell you, this is all my mother wanted for her birthday. This really is a terrific book. I think we've learned tremendously from you. I'm grateful for not only your frankness, but your eloquence. And thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for coming.